Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's May 4th, 37 degrees here and mostly sunny skies. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning, Adam.
Oh, good morning. And mostly sunny, but eventually you'll see some partly cloudy skies here this morning as a very weak cold front is progressing through the Wasatch Front and Wasatch back this morning. And that's just bringing in the additional cloud cover here as we progress through the morning hours. And that's really not going to do much in terms of hinder the daytime high temperature. We'll actually be pretty close to average, if not right at average in Park City, which is 55 degrees for that daytime high today. This is, as I mentioned, a pretty weak front, so there may not even be any showers with it. And if there is, it's going to be in the very high terrain of the Uintas. As far as tomorrow is concerned, though, we're going to be pushing 60 degrees under sunny skies. Low temperatures in the mid-30s here for the next few nights. And then by Thursday, which was where we'll apex our heat or our warmth, we're looking at mostly sunny to eventually partly cloudy conditions in the afternoon ahead of a new cold front. Again, a pretty weak one with regards to precipitation, but not as much regards to temperature because it rolls through Friday morning. We'll be definitely cooler after a 71-degree high on Thursday. We'll be about 5 to 7 degrees cooler in the mid-60s. 65 will be the high in Park City. And we'll see more cloud cover here for the remainder of the week. But as we head into Mother's Day weekend, we're going to be a bunch cooler where we're only going to be in the upper 40s both Saturday and Sunday, with a high on Mother's Day of just 47 with a chance of some isolated mountain showers around, but a better shot next Monday with a high in and around 50 degrees. And we're also looking at 40 to 50% chances of showers in the area. So we still have several more days before we get to that period of time. But for now, it's just enjoying the warmth as it, like I said, apexes on Thursday.
Okay. Thanks, Adam. KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher, taking a look at the agenda for Wednesday's County Council meeting. Later on, Summit County Transportation Planner Chris Putt with details about this year's Bike Share program and an update on the University of Utah Bike Rack Design Challenge. Finally, Cheryl Fox, Director of Summit Land Conservancy, has an update on several open space issues. Stay tuned. And coming up on This Green Earth, right after the local news hour, today's guests include Diana Movikas, Director of Global Forest Policy with a nonprofit group, Climate Advisor. She talks about how private businesses and countries are developing financial incentives to protect and preserve threatened tropical rainforests. Then Recycle Utah joining the program to talk about the tons of different types of hazardous waste and materials that were collected during the Hazardous Waste Drop-Off Day held on April 24th. Then Jeff Busson, Climate Program Manager with Utah Clean Energy, summarizes the work a community advisory committee has performed over this past year, identifying and prioritizing energy efficiency and reduction solutions for Park City and Summit County. All of that coming up on This Green Earth, right after, again, the local news hour and NPR News.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we're celebrating Mother's Day. We have the mother-son duo of Jewel Robinson and Kwame Onwuachi talking about how she inspired him to become a lauded chef. We take Mother's Day cooking questions with Melissa Clark, and we hear about the Korean birthday soup tradition of myeokguk. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
Join us for The Splendid Table here on KPCW every Sunday starting at 9 a.m.
KPCW News Time now, 8:10. Good morning. Well, the Summit County Council is meeting Wednesday starting at 2:45 via Zoom. On the phone with a preview, I have Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
So before we get to the agenda items, wanted to ask you the fact that at least one Summit County Council member has expressed some concern over Park City's plans to build a contaminated soil repository near Quinn's Junction. Is that something that the rest of the council or the county is concerned about?
Well, I mean, It is a concern of the county because all of this activity is happening within Summit County. The county has its own concerns around anything to do with soils. We're very experienced with that around OU 1, 2, and 3. So I imagine we are having some internal meetings today in order to final county comments into the DEQ process, and that's where our input will be provided.
Okay, and can you give me, can you summarize what those comments might look like?
I really can't yet because I haven't had that meeting to hear everything from staff that we might be concerned about. That will be a letter under my letterhead, and we'll make that available to anybody that wants to see it.
All right. Well, gosh, I'm trying to think back. I mean, it was a while ago, back in maybe 2015 or something, where the council met to discuss bevel-exempt soils, and then nothing. I mean, something took place, apparently, that the county just kind of dropped the agenda item and still nothing. So where do things stand with that discussion that really never happened?
Are you talking about the city council's activity or county council?
County council. Yeah.
I'm not recalling the discussion about bevel exempt soils that you're referring to.
Okay. I'll have to go back and see if I can find something about that.
Because doesn't mean it didn't happen. Yeah, There's been a lot that's gone on over the last year.
Yeah, but I mean, it was something that the county was looking at, and then it was just like we never heard from it again. It was
gotcha.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. The meeting agenda. First up, you'll be hearing from County Attorney Margaret Olson, who will be explaining her department's conviction integrity unit. We'll be talking to her about this more next week, but maybe you can just tell us a little bit about what this unit is and does it require council approval here?
Well, I'm assuming it is something that the county attorney's office is forwarding and bringing to the council's attention for information. But essentially what it, you know, looking through the staff notes on this, it provides an avenue for cases that or convictions that have happened and there's new information that would change, that could possibly change that conviction. It allows there to be a review of that so that the system can make corrections as needed. I think, you know, as far as getting into more detail, it probably makes more sense to talk to Margaret about that.
Okay. Let's see, the council then meeting as the Board of Equalization to decide whether to offer property tax exemptions. I mean, there are a handful of nonprofits like the Historical Society, St. Luke's Church, Center of Excellence, Christian Center, Mountain Lands Community Housing. I mean, it sounds like they are verifiable nonprofits. So the problem here is that they just forgot to do something?
Well, I mean, you'll recall in past years that every once in a while a nonprofit will have missed some kind of deadline in regards to their application. And as I remember, these are applications that need to be made on a regular basis in order to keep that status so that their property tax exemption stays in place. It was unclear with the staff report whether these are just the regular process for these nonprofits, and these are the ones that are being brought forward this year, or whether there is some other kind of change in how these are handled within the assessor's office that will be described by the two staff members from the assessor's office and the recorder's office.
Yeah. Now, does the county often find property that isn't being used as it was intended after getting perhaps a tax break?
I would say that happens every once in a while. Probably the best case, and it's not deliberate. It's simply a change in status. If there's a property that's acquired for, say, an affordable housing project by one of the nonprofits that does that, and then that status changes, or they don't build right away, or something like that, there could be some kind of change. But generally speaking, the nonprofits that we work with are very open and honest about how they're using those properties, so it's a pretty simple process.
All right. Council also scheduled to discuss and possibly adopt a resolution authorizing the issuance and sale of $8.8 million sales tax revenue bonds. What's this going to be used for?
Well, I mean, this is the result of the voters reapproving the Recreation Arts and Parks tax for another 10-year period. You'll recall in the past two decades, each time that the voters have done that, the county has issued bonds against 50% of that revenue that goes towards recreation, and we have funded larger recreation projects that get distributed throughout the county based on kind of population numbers And so this will be the largest amount that the county has ever issued for bonds against this tax source because of the growth in the tax base or the sales tax numbers. So we'll have some very significant projects being granted out this year, and we'll have more details on that process after the bonds are let.
Okay, so this is, we're talking about this almost $9 million for the next 10 years. Is that what you're bonding for?
Well, the bond will be a 10-year bond supported under this tax. And so that revenue that we get from that bond will be granted out to projects that are applied for through a grant process this year.
So what are some of those larger projects that you're hearing about?
Well, I haven't heard anything real specific yet. The only meeting that I'm aware of has been with some of the North Summit area recreation interests. But in the past, there have been trail projects. The Red Barn in Oakley was one of the projects. There were projects in the Echo area. And you'll recall that the North Summit Recreation District built a park in the last 10 years, and those were funded by, that park was funded both in a property acquisition and some of the construction by these bond funds.
Okay. And just speaking of bonds, anything moving ahead with regard to some of the transportation bonding, you know, the money that we were using for that from that fourth and fifth quarter sales tax that was used to finish the Pine Brook and Jeremy roundabout project?
So you're actually talking about the third quarter, and I'm not going to remember the exact name of that tax, but that's the one that we bonded against.
Okay.
So certainly the Jeremy Ranch interchange was one of the larger projects that was funded out of that. You're going to see we're still working on right-of-way acquisition around the Bittner to Silver Creek connection. And then there are several there are several projects in the Park City area that I'll let them represent more the specifics of, but a lot of their work on 248, I believe, is funded out of that tax.
Okay. The neighborhood mixed-use zone back for possible approval. We've been talking about this for, gosh, maybe 3 years. Do we have any holdups at this point?
Well, I mean, I think the council still has questions and things that they'd like to see taken care of or at least addressed within these. And we do have some difference of opinion on the council about how those issues, some of them around for affordable housing, should be addressed by these two ordinances or code changes. So we're going to see some more discussion about that. But as you note, we also have a joint meeting with the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission after these discussions. So I would imagine we're going to, if it doesn't pass today during the regular time, we're going to hear a little bit more about it during that joint meeting as well.
All right. Just skimming the staff report on this, it sounds like the biggest building in a mixed-use zone could be up to 50,000 square feet. We're also talking about 45-foot height limits, which could be expanded to up to 60 feet for affordable housing or structured parking. How does this all work, given the Section 2.3 of our development code that does not allow more density unless there is a compelling need? I mean, even the ordinance itself doesn't limit density. It only says that density will be determined by the ability of the proposed development to meet all of the required development standards. I mean, this could be some of the most dense development in the entire county, yeah?
It could be, and I guess that depends on, you know, the theory of the nodal development, where we want more dense development around our transportation nodes so that they both feed transit better with more density, but also they're concentrated so that we don't sprawl or encourage sprawl. That's the whole purpose of the master plan development process, is that those things would be determined through that process, and would it be a give and take around those things. And part of what has been hard about this whole discussion is imagining some of those guidelines and how they would be applied. There are things and there are problems to be solved in our community, and there is still land to be developed. So we want to make sure that we have a process in place that both solves some of those problems, but does so in a way that also is supportable by the market.
So I'm not sure, do you recall what this property is zoned as currently?
Which property are we talking about?
Well, near the 40 intersection, the SIG property, the property that the county owns.
I can't represent specifically because, you know, obviously the county owns some property in that area as well, and I believe it's rural residential. I don't remember whether the property that the SIG group owns is community commercial already or is rural residential.
All right. There, at some point, the council was talking about wanting to increase the required percentage of affordable housing in a mixed-use development from 20, which is currently the standard, up to as much as 50. It sounds like the staff is recommending that not happen. And maybe you can explain why, just because it's asking too much.
Well, I think staff and council member Clyde are probably a little more aligned on that point, in that they believe that should be addressed in the general plan as opposed to and in the code specifically as opposed to this zone. So it's just a difference of opinion of where that should be. And I think that's, as I described, one of the discussion points that still needs to be settled.
All right. And then there's also discussion about allowing a fee in lieu of building affordable housing to happen. As we've seen in the past, I mean, these fees don't come anywhere close to paying for what it costs to build. So why would we consider that? I mean, why not just make the developer build it?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question that needs to be discussed. And the other part of that is that, you know, we really haven't had a development happen within the last few years that has paid any fee in lieu because they have developed the affordable housing with their projects. I can certainly see cases where there could be development based on land that is still to be developed, that fee in lieu could be more appropriate. And so I think the council is thinking through that whole idea and trying to decide the best place to address that issue.
Yeah. Also, one of the recommendations from staff is that, if this is what we're going to do, is that we probably... to increase anything in terms of the percentage wise would need to do another needs assessment. It sounds like we've done about a half dozen of these already, no?
Well, we have done several needs assessments and it's probably been 2 to 3 years since we've updated it, and it could be the right time. What we have done on an annual basis in order to meet state requirements is do a workforce housing plan. And that has been adopted. So, you know, sometimes it's kind of confusing about what document to be looking at for some of these guidance items.
Okay. And then, as you mentioned earlier, a joint meeting with the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission at 6 o'clock, and an update on the general plan and development code. Any specific direction that you know that the council wants to give to the Planning Commission here?
Well, I mean, both the Planning Commission and through the council have been very aggressive this year in some of the things they've been working on, whether it be accessory buildings, discussions around affordable housing, solar energy. All of those types of things are being brought forward at a pretty good clip to the council for the council's deliberation. And I think there's some discussion that can happen around those items, plus what the schedule is going to be for the rest of the year. Because at some point we're probably being somewhat, too aggressive in working these groups. But, you know, there's a lot of things that people want to get done too. So, that balance has to be struck between the Planning Commission and the Council.
Okay. And then and finally, I just wanted to ask you, we need a new county clerk. How is that process going to work since it's an elected office?
So, you know, automatically, and this was a change in state law, the deputy is appointed as interim. That is, it doesn't take an act of anybody anymore. It's just an automatic interim appointment. But that does not fill the office. So the process is that the party has a certain number of days, or the since Kent Jones was a Democrat, the Democrat Party has a certain number of days to put forward a recommendation to the council to ratify. And I believe that I know that the party has been noticed. So that process is already started.
Okay. And then that would, that person would serve till the end of the year. And then in November's election, it's that person.
I think because of the timing, they would serve until the 2022 election cycle, where there would be an open seat at that point.
Okay. All right, Tom, anything else you want to mention?
Just that we're recruiting a North Summit Fire District board member right now, and that closes on May 9th at 5 p.m.
Great. Tom Fisher, Summit County Manager, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:28. Well, more than 200 avalanche fences are slated to go in above two homes in the colony. KPCW's Jessica Lowell reports Vail Resorts obtained permission to build the fences through a low-impact permit that did not require the project to go through the public review process.
The avalanche fencing was approved for a low-impact permit about 10 months ago by the Summit County Community Development Department. The paneled fences will be about 10 to 15 feet tall and wide and would act as a barrier to protect a driveway and two houses from avalanches. Community activist Jake Hutchinson says he was blindsided when he heard the fences were approved.
There's a few of us that have kind of been paying attention and waiting for this to come in front of the Planning Commission for a couple of years now. And then we found out 10 months later that it had already been approved. We were quite surprised. And, you know, it really seems a little backwards to me that you can put a private driveway into a slide path and then deal with the natural hazard after the fact.
He, along with other outspoken community members, brought up concerns over visual and environmental impacts, along with the potential negative effects of construction crews installing the fences. Hutchinson says when he worked as a ski patroller and director of patrol at the canyons, he saw firsthand the impacts these barriers have on wildlife.
We pulled two bull elk out of those fences that had become entangled and had some rather untimely, probably long, painful deaths caught in those fences. And over my years there, I can't count how many animals we pulled out of there, primarily in the summer. You know, the fences that are planned in this area are a different manufacturer, but have no less impact.
Instead of fences, Hutchinson says there are other ways to mitigate avalanches.
There's lower impact ways for them to deal with it. Similar to what happens in Little Cottonwood Canyon or Teton Pass, where they use remote avalanche control systems. And the downside is those two homeowners would probably experience some sort of a few minutes of delay once every 10 or 15 years to access their homes. Instead, we're going to put the most extreme, most impactful mitigation device up there as the first solution rather than look at other potential solutions.
Other community members also spoke out about the fences during the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission meeting last week. But the Planning Commission doesn't approve low-impact permits. Chairman Ryan Dickey says the project never came before the commission, so he's learning alongside everyone else.
So we heard that feedback. It sounds like the reality is this is a permit that was approved almost a year ago. The appeal process for that has long passed. But we heard the public comment, and where it goes from here, you know, is TBD. It's just not something that is within our purview as a planning commission.
Summit County Council member Doug Clyde says the obligation for the fences was made decades ago when the colony development was first approved. He says ski resorts in Summit County are on private land, meaning in the same way the county can't tell the resorts how to load their chairlifts, he says they also can't tell them how to mitigate avalanches.
Largely, we would be hard-pressed to go in there and say, well, we don't care what your goal is, and we don't care whether you meet your safety requirements. We just want this to be different. I don't think that that is consistent with our previous agreements. Would we do things differently now? I don't know.
Clyde says the time to discuss the permit has come and gone. But concerned Park City resident Brian Van Hecke told KPCW it's not too late until the fences are up.
It's not a done deal. It has not been, this has not been started. And, this has to meet the strategic goals and the plans of Summit County. There's an opportunity here with the council's initiative and approval to stop this from happening. And again, go back to the planning process and do this the right way.
For now, Clyde says the fences are a done deal, but there's a possibility the council could talk about the barriers in the future, as well as new regulations. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
It's 8:32 now. Good morning. Well, the Summit County e-bike share program is back in business. On the phone with details, I have Summit County Transportation Planner Chris Putt. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So how many bikes do we have available for rent?
So as of just this past Saturday, all 20 stations and all 190 bikes are back on the streets and available to be ridden. So far, we've already seen a pretty awesome number of use too. We've seen about 280 rides just in the first couple days, and about 1,000 miles on the bikes this season already.
Okay, so anything new this year? I mean, did we add more stations, more bikes?
There's no new stations planned, and we have the same number of, we still have that 190 bikes. We do have some software updates, so a lot of the dead spots that have been hit in the past, which is still pretty rare, but those, the possibility for it, it seems like our team at Bowiegan has come up with some solutions for that. So just mostly some improved connectivity and software updates, but otherwise it's the same rideshare we've all come to know and love.
Okay, so tell us how it works. If someone's interested in riding one of these bikes, they got to register first?
Yep, so you can actually do a paper ride at a kiosk, but we also have an app, the Summit Bike Share app. We offer a couple different options for payment. We do a monthly pass and for $32.15, a annual pass that's $96.44, or you can do the pay per ride that's $3 for a 30-minute ride, or and then 15 cents per minute after that 30-minute ride.
Okay. And then in terms of where to find a kiosk, is that part of the app or is that online, or how do people know where to go?
It's both online and on the app. We do have a little mapping feature that will actually have pins to all 20 locations, so fairly easy to find.
All right. And then in terms of the assistance, do we have that now still online in terms of somebody here to go back and pick up bikes and make sure that there's bikes at every station?
We do, yeah. Bowiegan actually just hired two new staff members to help with that, balancing those kiosks as well as doing some mechanic work. So same great team with a couple new additions coming into the season.
Okay. Let's see. And then you expect that to run through, I guess, until the snow flies or mid-October, or when does it usually last till?
Yeah, generally speaking, I mean, knowing Park City, you know how it goes. It kind of depends when the snow starts flying, but we like to try and get through the fall each season just because especially the last couple of years, we've seen really high ridership, up and through that October period. So weather is always kind of a determinant in that sense. But as long as we can keep them open, we usually have a hard date that we try and set for closing. But if we can keep them open a little past that, we always try and do that.
All right. And the whole idea was behind this program was to keep cars off the roads. Do we have any kind of statistics, some survey results that show that the majority of riders are in fact using it as alternate transportation, or is it just more joyriding?
I think we get a little bit of both. I don't have the hard numbers in front of me right now, but I know we've actually seen a rise in annual passes, which to us kind of suggests those annual passes will be the people that are riding it daily for those trips and kind of as a mobility solution. But then I think the majority, for sure, you get those paper rides, those daily or monthly riders, which for sure, being Summit County, we get a lot of people from out of town, I think, who use them as both a source for, something to do and a good way to see the town. But the way we like to look at that is the other option would be taking an Uber or a taxi or driving. So if they're using the bikes to see our beautiful city and our mountains and our paths, then that in my mind is still a car off the road.
All right. Let's see. You're also working on a bike rack challenge. This is being done by University of Utah students. So tell us more about this.
Yeah, we have a couple bike rack programs going on right now. Lots of stuff happening in the bike world in terms of transportation. So one of the initiatives, and I believe you've mentioned it with Tom Fisher on your show before, but we're calling it the Innovative Design Challenge. So what we've done is working with the undergraduate students at the College of Architecture and Planning at the University of Utah. We gave them up until May 1st, basically, to sign up for this challenge. We got a pretty awesome response. I think we have 9 teams. We tasked them with designing a bike rack that will eventually be fabricated and installed at the Journey Ranch Park and Ride. There's some parameters around the design. Obviously, we want it to be innovative, but we also want it to be aesthetically pleasing. We want it to solve issues, and we want it to maybe bring something new to what a bike rack can be, whether that be improved locking, shelter, we're really excited to see what these students can come up with. I know a couple people myself who throughout the years have actually gone through that program, so I know what that program produces, and I'm really excited to see what their current crop of students can create.
Yeah, were there some givens there that they had to design racks that held a certain number of bikes?
So number of bikes, not so much. We created a full document of standards and guidelines that should guide them through the do's and don'ts of bike racks in general. And it's going to be a guiding document that we hope we use ourselves when we're just implementing not custom bike racks. So they will have to be, small things like they have to be surface mounted. We have recommended materials, design elements that best choice racks on the market today have. But in terms of aesthetics and number of bikes, we kind of left that up to them. One thing that we did tell them is, design a rack somewhat similar to, or not, I guess not somewhat similar, but, the best option now that we see, and it's kind of widely regarded as the best option, is called the Inverted U. It's just that staple style rack that you'll see kind of throughout town. And so those hold 2 racks. Obviously, being able to fabricate multiple of those and place them on a pad makes the most sense. But again, that's the best choice right now. Maybe they come up with something better.
Sure. Who decides who wins the contest?
We haven't put together the full decision committee yet. We're hoping to have some members of the public, some members of council, and I'm hoping to get a faculty member from the U as well.
All right. And I'm guessing that the kids aren't getting paid for this, but could add it to their resume.
There will be a prize. I think the winning team will split $1,000 prize for the win, and that will, again, secure that design will then be owned by High Valley Transit and Summit County. But then again, I think even more so, as you touched on, I think just the experience of working real time and designing within actual parameters and seeing their project get built just from that standpoint of experience and a resume builder is huge for those students.
Sure. And you're also asking for suggestions about where to put bike racks?
So we put together a Request a Rack program that went live on the High Valley Transit website yesterday. And this is in conjunction with Park City. So theirs has been live for about 2 weeks now. So not necessarily a suggestion of where to put them, but business owners, property owners can go on, fill out an online form and request bicycle racks for their business and their property and their development. There'll be short-term bike racks. There'll be that U-style rack that I touched on. The number of which they receive will be based on a site visit and what's actually feasible on their property. The racks will be completely free to them. They'll basically just sign an agreement over allowing us to install them.
Oh, okay. So who's paying? Summit and Park City taxpayers?
It'll be Summit and Park City. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be out of active transportation funds, at least from our end for sure. And then I believe Park City's will be the same.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want to add?
No, that's it. Just exciting things on the bike front happening throughout town. So,
all right, Chris, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Summit County Transportation Planner Chris Putt. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:42. And in the studio now with an update on some open space issues, I have Cheryl Fox, Executive Director of Summit Land Conservancy. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you wanted to talk about a deal that got away?
We have a deal that got away. It doesn't happen very often, fortunately. But this one did. Some people might have heard that the Summit Land Conservancy was working with a partner to acquire 15 acres on Boulderville Road, which is just outside of the Oakley city limits. And the property isn't exactly adjacent to the river, but pretty close to the Weber River. And we were hoping to purchase this property. It was on the market, and create a public access nature preserve where people could also be buried. And, you know, we are in a situation here in Summit County where land prices are very high. There isn't a, you know, it's really difficult to find ways to save open space. And yet, you know, people all the time are calling our office or are asking us, save it, save it, save more. So we had hoped that, you know, we could do something here that was a little bit different and use, a market-based system for saving open space. So last week, some consultants came out who are familiar with conservation burial, and they walked the property, and while they found that it was appropriate geologically for, you know, this use, it was really too small. Conservation burial needs to be on a 20-acre parcel, and it was also a little too expensive. And so we, over the weekend, made the difficult decision to step back and let that go. But I think that, I think that it's time that we have some conversations around maybe what happens at the end of our lives and how we want our remains treated and how we impact the environment and the earth with those decisions that we make. And so this has been a terrific learning process for me and for our organization in terms of, you know, what happens if you pick embalming and concrete vaults and things like that, or even cremation.
So, well, let's talk a little bit about, how does a conservation burial ground differ from a cemetery?
Well, the main difference is it doesn't look like a cemetery. It looks like a nature preserve. There are trails, there's public access, there are no, you know, big monuments or headstones. There's no lawn and sprinklers and watering and things like that. So the beauty of conservation burial is that it creates a nature preserve. And people hike and have picnics and meditate and all that kind of thing. It looks just like any other protected open space.
So where do the remains go?
They get buried. And they are buried in such a way that they return to earth, as it will, very quickly, actually.
So entire bodies or cremation?
The initial plan for this was entire bodies only, because cremation also has, you know, a carbon footprint, and the remains after cremation have, in addition to some heavy metals, some salts and things like that, that if you just pack it and put it in the ground, create a dead spot in the ground. Or if you sprinkle them, as people do, sprinkle ashes, that can also be toxic. So a lot of people don't realize that. We think that cremation is it's less expensive, so we think it's better, but it really isn't great for the environment. Our bodies are natural, you know, for the most part. Depends on how many Doritos you eat, I think. But we're meant to be returned.
Yeah. So what's the difference, though, between letting just a body dissolve, I suppose, and the cremation? Because those salts and heavy metals are still in a body.
It has to do, I think, with the process. And ashes, if you mix them with other substances that can neutralize those toxics that are in those ashes and then put them in a place that's appropriate. So the consultants who came out last week actually talked about some ways to handle that, which we had not been planning on doing on this parcel initially. But anyway, now that's part of the conversation going forward, is to how do we maybe find another piece of ground. And again, you know, it needs to be, it can't just be any old piece of ground. It needs to be a place where people are going to want to walk and have public access and, you know, connect to other trails, hopefully.
Yeah. So on a 20-acre parcel, how many bodies could go there?
A lot.
Like, what's a lot?
I think it's about 300 an acre.
Oh, my.
Yep. A lot can go in a traditional cemetery. I don't want to call it traditional. This actually, these types of preserves are really the more traditional way, the way humans handled the end of life, you know, for thousands and thousands of years. It's safe. It does not impact water. The remains are returned to the earth quite quickly. In the last, you know, 100 years or so with embalming, that puts a lot of toxic chemicals in the ground. And then also, you know, we put them in concrete vaults, which is also very carbon intensive. So there are a lot of things about the sort of modern cemetery, if you will, that are not environmentally friendly at all. So this was an opportunity where people could make an end-of-life choice that, in addition to doing something that was, you know, carbon neutral or maybe even carbon positive, but also created a public access nature preserve or a sanctuary. So it was really sort of a beautiful combination of things.
And then how do you decide who gets to go into that?
Well, our partner was, you know, really taking on the financial burden of acquiring the land. And so it was going to be, you know, people would buy plots from her as you know, you'd buy a plot anywhere.
Hmm. Okay. Let's see. What's the latest then to preserve the Mountain Spa property there in Midway?
We are moving forward. Again, we have a lot of partners coming to the table on that one. The big question there was water and whether or not there was enough water for the development. And that looks like those problems have been solved. So we expect that closing to happen in July. There may be some community fundraising that we need to do around that piece. You know, there's going to be a spa resort on that property. Midway wants to have the spa because it would support their resort city sales tax. The people who are building the spa have a really, again, environmental, global, beautiful image of this. So, you know, in the resort zone in Midway, pretty much the sky's the limit in how much density you can build. This developer has a memorandum of understanding with the Summit Land Conservancy where they're limiting it to 250,000 square feet of development, which is pretty significant, right? Anyway, so there's a lot of moving pieces on this one, but there has been movement and we're excited.
All right, but some 45 acres will still remain open then.
That's right. So the views, as you know, along Bergie Lane and River Road, as you look up towards the mountains, those open spaces will be protected.
And then the pools will be reopened to the public someday?
That's the idea.
Mm-hmm. Nice. All right, and then you've also been working with the Ogden Valley Land Trust to save the former monastery in Huntsville. How's that going?
That's going so well. It's such a pleasure to work with a sister organization like the Ogden Valley Land Trust. They're all volunteers, and so they're you know, dedicated and passionate and very well connected in the Ogden Valley community. They've been doing a tremendous job. It's a really nice partnership, right? Because we have the capacity to get the big federal grant and apply for some other grants. And they know people in the community who are interested in seeing the property protected as a farm, a working farm. So it's just been a great partnership, and we are incredibly grateful to the landowner there. We had thought we were going to go for some quality growth money, which the state is a state funding source, the Lee Ray McAllister Fund. But the governor's budget, the final budget, only included $1 million for that. And that's for conservation all across the state of Utah. That is a very small, I mean, I know $1 million sounds like a lot of money, but it is a very small amount of money for land conservation, and especially compared to what, you know, Wyoming or Idaho or Colorado or Montana put aside as a state into land conservation. So our landowner has generously decided that we don't need to tap into that pot of money, which means that it's available for other projects across the state, which I think is pretty amazing.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I will say that if people are interested in creating a nature sanctuary, a public access nature sanctuary where other people or where people can be buried, I'd love to talk to them. I talked to some other land trusts that do these kinds of things. And, you know, it would be great if we could find someone who would be interested in purchasing land for this purpose. And then finally, Mark Miller Subaru does the Do Good, Feel Good in the month of May, and you can buy a car and save land at the same time.
How's that?
We are one of their nonprofit partners. So if you buy a car during the month of May, you get to pick one of their nonprofit partners to receive a cash donation.
Okay. How much will you get? Do you know?
$75 per car.
Okay.
And then there's some other prizes as well. So.
Yeah. All right, Cheryl. Talk to you next month. Thanks.
Thank you.
Cheryl Fox, Executive Director of Summit Land Conservancy. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:53. The deadline to submit comments on a proposed contaminated soil landfill at Quinns Junction expires today at 5 p.m. There are last-minute concerns being raised by the public, and at least one Summit County Council member is asking Park City officials to delay the deadline. Even though Park City has been talking about the landfill slated to go out on what's known as the Gordo property for more than a year now, concerned residents just learning about it. The repository would be built on city-owned property near Quinns Junction. Some 35,000 cubic yards of contaminated soil due to historic mining operations is already there, and it's estimated that the city will add another 35,000 to 50,000 cubic yards as it prepares the Arts and Culture District for development. Like a landfill, a big pit will be dug, then lined, and eventually capped once it's been filled. The bulk of the 22 acres is zoned residential development. Some of the property was purchased using open space bond funds and is zoned recreation open space. A year ago, the city received word from the Division of Waste Management and Radioactive Control that a contaminated soils repository in that location would be an appropriate use for the property. The property is also being considered as the permanent recyclable materials processing facility for Recycle Utah. Critics have paid to send out robocalls telling residents that they must send an email to the Department of Environmental Quality before 5 p.m. today.
Hello, this is a courtesy call to let you know about a new landfill for contaminated soils that may soon be coming to Park City. The proposed landfill was tentatively approved by Utah's Division of Waste Management and Radiation Control, but there's still time to stop it.
Summit County Councilmember Roger Armstrong declined to be interviewed on air, but he did refer us to a Facebook post he wrote detailing his concerns. There, he said he doesn't think the city's plan was fully disclosed to the county council, especially since the proposed facility sits near the county's border and relates to their ongoing soil cleanup efforts. He adds that he's not suggesting that the city's plan is good or terrible, but he is urging residents to request critical information from the city before this initiative moves further. Armstrong doesn't think the city did a good job reaching out to residents, asking them if they wanted a hazardous waste facility to be opened and operated. If the city had, he thinks that it would have had led to a more robust discussion, with experts providing insight as to the public health risks, the cost, and administrative burdens. Armstrong is requesting that the mayor and Park City Council extend the public comment period to allow for more public discussion. The city held an impromptu Zoom gathering meeting last week to answer questions after the robocall went out. But without a lot of promotion, only a handful of residents participated. Park City Mayor Andy Bierman is steering residents to the city's website for more accurate information.
Anyone that has questions on that, I encourage them to go to the city website. We've posted some FAQs about what we're doing out there and what is myth and what is true, and they're welcome to reach out. But the short version of that is we have soils all over town for a decade plus. We've been looking for a safe place to put those, and so we've been temporarily storing those soils for that decade on the Gordo parcel. Working with the EPA and the state, we decided the best thing to do was to put a lined Class 1 landfill in there and store them right on site, as well as additional soils from road projects, the arts and culture, and probably make that available for small residential projects.
According to Park City Senior Project Manager for the repository, Matt Twombly, it's costing the city $1.2 million for the first phase of the repository. That includes all of the construction to build the cell, as well as capping it and revegetating it. The first cell would take care of the 35,000 cubic yards of material that's already out there, plus what's expected to come from the Arts and Culture District. The landfill could not be used by commercial developers unless the city partnered with a private developer to do an affordable housing project on city land. For all future phases, the city is required to budget for the closure, which Twombly says has been done. It was estimated that it would cost the city about $5 million to haul the dirt from the Arts and Culture District to the Tooele repository instead of here to a local repository. For now, the Utah Department of Environmental Quality is again accepting public comments via email through today, 5 p.m. That email address is dwmrcpublic@utah.gov. You must use a required note in the subject line, public comment on Park City Soils Management Facility Class 1 Landfill Draft Permit. That's a lot. You can find out more by going to our website, kpcw.org, clicking on this story. You'll find all of that information there. News time now, 8:58.
Current and relevant information matters to let you know what is going on around you locally, nationally, and internationally. KPCW makes this happen with this nonprofit news organization. With underwriting, KPCW can get the message about your business to our informed and dedicated listeners. Want to support the local news hour and NPR's morning edition? We're looking for a few more sponsors. For information about this program and all underwriting opportunities, contact Emily at kpcw.org.
A Summit County Sheriff deputy responded to a call on Saturday that five people showed up at the Summit County Health Center in Camas to protest and discourage patients from taking the COVID-19 vaccination. Sheriff's Lieutenant Andrew Wright told KPCW that a Summit County Health Department employee notified them.
A small group of people who were in front of the Health Department office in Camas. The group was allegedly approaching people who were there to receive the COVID vaccine, and these anti-vaxxers were attempting to dissuade the residents from getting the vaccine. When our deputy arrived, he approached the group of five individuals who were in front of the health department office. They told the deputy that they were there to get information. When the deputy asked them what kind of information they were after, they said they wanted to know why anyone would get the vaccine.
The deputy on the scene told the anti-vaxxers that they could not interfere with patients.
One of the females did proceed to tell the deputy that they were doing the health department a favor due to the fact that the vaccine was not approved by the FDA. Our deputy, of course, told these individuals that they were not allowed to physically restrict people from receiving the vaccine, and it sounds like they were compliant and understood that they couldn't prevent people from getting the vaccine.
And, of course, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has authorized for emergency use the Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The Summit County Health Department will continue to provide COVID-19 vaccines at each of the county's three health department locations in Colville, Park City, and Camas. This is KPCW Park City.